Well, by now you've heard Yadier Molina is going to be in the All-Star game, his 10th appearance for the Cardinals catcher. Alex Reyes making his first. Nolan Arenado making his sixth. Arenado, our guest last week on the Kilcoyne Conversation, but somebody who is a regular at the Midsummer Classic, that would be Rick Hummel of the Post-Dispatch. 40-plus years straight of going to the All-Star game, covering baseball for the Post-Dispatch, covering sports for the Post-Dispatch for 50 years. The commish, Rick Hummel, just celebrated his 50th anniversary at the Post. Started getting into the baseball coverage in the late 70s, coming from Mizzou, hired by Bob Bregg, the legendary Bob Bregg. And over the years, the commish, so many different stories. So we thought we'd sit him down, run through all of it, memories of Jack Buck. Mike Shannon, who he's working with right now, currently working on a book with Mike Shannon. Also, Tony La Russa, Whitey Herzog, stories throughout the years. And that one time he was covering Leon Spinks, and he got kicked out of the press conference by Mr. T. All part of the 50 years in the business for the one and only commish. Rick Hummel really is a gentleman, always pleasant. And for years, when Tony La Russa would conduct his interviews, he would sort of quiet everybody down and look at Rick. He would just kind of nod. And that meant that the commish would go first, Rick Hummel. So he is the subject of the latest Kilcoyne Conversation. It's presented by B&G Tuck Pointing, the best in the bricks. So if that mortar is starting to fall apart, your chimney, your garage, your home, a lot of brick buildings in St. Louis, you know that. Make sure you're getting the best in the bricks. BGTuckPointing.com is their website. 363-0525 is where you can call, get a free estimate, whether it's the home, the garage, the chimney, whatever work you need done, waterproofing, foundation repair, bgtuckpointing.com. It shows a lot of their work when you go to the website. Check it out. Give them a call. Ask for Rich Galati by name. Great sponsor of the Kilcoyne Conversation. Also, Triad Bank, looking for that second location soon. Triad Bank started in St. Louis in 2005. Five-star rated bank. And when you go into the lobby there in Frontenac, actual people there willing to help you out. Friendly people. How about that? Nice, friendly folks at Triad Bank. And if you're a business person in St. Louis wanting to do more business, make sure you're talking to Jim Regna, his entire team. TriadBanking.com is their website. Also, Marie Davila Senior Living, corner of Clayton and Wideman Road since 1960. Premier spot for senior living. Villa estates, assisted living, all of it. Take a virtual tour at Marie Davila. com. This audio, by the way, you're wondering, what is going on? This is how we improvise. And family day trip vacation for just a quick trip. Holiday World over in Santa Claus, Indiana. We had a great time. But I realized I didn't cut my ins and my outs, as we call it, for the Rick Hummel piece. And I had to get it done. We're at a truck stop somewhere in Indiana. Little scene behind the curtain there. You're like, dude, get in the studio. Well, I would have, but we're doing what we got to do here. Great sponsors include Appliance Discounters, great GE merchandise, those GE rebates, and now an 80,000 square foot showroom in warehouse in downtown St. Louis, which allows the showrooms to have even more inventory. But if you order an appliance, especially a General Electric appliance, you're going to get it soon. That's what Appliance Discounters can do, because of the giant warehouse in downtown St. Louis. TheAppliancedDiscounters.com. Don't have the other guys telling you they'll get it to you in a month or 2 months. Get it in a couple of days. Appliance Discounters. Stop by any of their showrooms around the St. Louis area or on the web at TheAppliancedDiscounters.com. This is my first ever audio recorded at a truck stop. But we had to get this baby turned around. Trust me. Also, don't forget about the great folks at Appliance Discounters, Marie Davila, BG Tuck Pointing, Triad Bank. That's all four of the great folks. Let's get to it. It's the commish. It's a great conversation. I hope you'll enjoy it. I feel like I have a lot of Rick Hummel knowledge, but it's all loosely correct. And so when people talk about the commish, I always say that's not because he's a baseball aficionado and he could have been the commissioner. It's about an office pool or so. Am I in the ballpark here?
Well, yes. Office pools are part of it. But the main reason why, I guess, was we had this football, DICE football league, APBA football. Very complicated, big boards. You had player cards referencing how guys did during the previous season, you know,
And I played it as a kid, yeah. Baseball, and you'd roll an 11 or a 66 yeah. Home runs and touchdowns.
Well, baseball, much easier. Football, very complicated, and we had about anywhere from 9 to 16 players, depending on what year it was. And only a couple of us knew how to read the boards, mostly me. And so I ended up going to all the games, whether my team was playing or not, and officiated, you know, otherwise the games would have taken 5 or 6 hours. It took 3 as it was.
So it went back to APBA. That was a great, man, the baseball cards and Willie Stargell. I feel like he hit 80 homers for me one summer league because it all was the roll of the dice.
And when he's up, you feel better about rolling. You know you're going to roll a good number.
Right. Now, does anybody call you Rick? Like, does your wife say commish? Do your kids say commish?
No.
No, nobody.
No. Well, I mean, my wife very occasionally, but most often just Rick or Ricky and the kids, you know, dad, you know.
But at the ballpark, it's all commish.
A lot of it is. I think it was maybe a guy like Suter when he was here in the early 80s. It gets passed down from one generation of players to the next, you know, and the new players come in, you know, and they'll call you Rick or whatever, and somebody will say to them, well, you know, we actually call them commish. And so so the day that somebody calls you commish and never called you that before, you like the day Holiday called me commish, I wheeled around like, oh, you're talking to me?
So, I mean, obviously somebody told Holiday,
yeah.
Hey, that's the commish.
Yeah.
Okay. When you started, did you think, hey, I'm gonna do this for a long time? I mean, you're 75 years old. I still see you at the ballpark. The players still call you commish. Did you think you'd still be doing it at this point?
No. When I started in newspapering, I didn't have any great desire to be covering any particular sport. I just wanted to be a sports writer. And baseball seemed to be far, far away because that's the one I followed the most as a kid, and they seemed bigger than life players, you know. They were like gods, and you were in their awed in their by their presence in your mind anyway. So I didn't have a chance to do that for the first couple of years I was there. I did high school stuff, and that was fine, and some college stuff, and then amateur boxing and a little hockey, and gradually some baseball. In 73, I started doing some baseball and became like a number three guy, then a number two guy a couple years later, and I'd be doing 30, 40 games a year. And 1978, Dick Cakel was our baseball writer, and he got promoted in the office to an executive position, and he said, why don't you do this baseball? It was like May of 78. So why don't you do this baseball the rest of the season? And I said, all right. And he said, let me know if you like it or not, and if you like it, it's yours. And so I said, I will. I'll tell you. And I liked it. And from then on, from in May of 78, I covered the team for until 2001 full-time, you know, and then I became kind of a hybrid writer after that. Now I'm kind of back where I was when I started out as a backup baseball writer, but I do a lot of games.
You still enjoy going to the park, still the manager scrums, although it's Zoom, it's been different. Now we're getting back to a little bit of normal, but you still enjoy the interaction and being at the park?
Yes and no. The Zooms are good for what they do on a short-term basis, but I'd hate to spend the rest of my career doing that. You miss the walking through the clubhouse and just seeing a guy and talking to him, just talking to him, maybe not even interviewing him. Just you had something you wanted to say to him, or you may have something he wanted to say to you. Or you might see a guy that's by himself and you thought, well, this is a good time to ask him about such and such because nobody else is around. I can maybe have the story for myself. And you don't get those opportunities anymore. You have to do it on the field before the game, and that's just recent. And that's doable. It's better than the alternative, which was none before the game, interaction with the players. So maybe next year it'll be kind of like it was. I don't know if we'll be in the clubhouse again, though. And that's – you have to live with that, I guess.
I don't see you as controversial or – a screaming match with a player, but was there ever a time you walked into the clubhouse pregame, you're just hanging out, and somebody said, Hummel, where are you at? Or did you really write this? Even La Russa, who I know you're friends with, may have a time or two picked something apart. Were there any occasions where you walked in and a player was really steamed?
Yes, but if he saw you there, let's say you'd written something the previous day or the same morning and talked to him the previous day, and he's ready to unload on you, but then you can see the wheels spinning. You start walking over to him, and you think, well, okay, he's here. I'm not going to explode. We're going to talk about this, but I'm not going to berate him or whatever. And generally it ends up like that. Now, one time, Joaquin Andujar, this was after a game, I'd written a long story about him for the Sunday paper early August of like 1985, I think. He was already at 19 wins. He was on his way to, 25, 28 wins. Never got there. At 21, I think, was his high. And he's pitching a Sunday game against Montreal. Big piece in the Sunday paper. And way down in it, I pointed out that Joaquin occasionally had some trouble with the boys in blue. And on this particular day, he walks maybe 3, 4, 5, loses the game 6-4. And after the game, he blames me for the umpires messing with him and not giving him the calls that he should have had. He had more walks than he usually had, and, not giving Montreal any credit for having a good game plan or whatever. So he rails on and on about this article. At least I appreciate the fact that either he or somebody read that far into it to look at it. And this goes on for about, 7 or 8 minutes.
Not like expletives and everything, just unloading?
Well, not from me, but from him.
Well, right. Yeah. No, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Yes. And the players are, it's right there. They can all hear it. Now they're getting tired of it, about Joaquin's starting to repeat himself. And finally, Jack Clark walks over to him and says, Joaquin, why don't you just shut the blank up? And and Joaquin was kind of afraid of Jack Clark. Jack Clark was a big man.
Yeah.
And he shut the blank up right away. And that was the end of that. And Joaquin, the next day they were in Houston, and he apologized for his behavior. But that's the only time that I had a real session with him. I had one session with Whitey in a hotel room one time way, way back when the topic of Gary Templeman came up. And that was a hot-button issue, of course. And
this while he was on the team?
No, he'd been traded to San Diego. And he'd said something. Temple had said something afterward. And Whitey was all upset. He thought I should have pointed out the fact that he was why he was in the rehab center, that it was drug-related or whatever. But I said, I can't say that. You guys can say it. I can't say that. And the next day, he forgot about it. It was all right. It was one night.
Did Whitey sit around, after games with the writers? Would you literally have beers and just sit in the office and BS, or am I imagining that?
When spring training, especially, it was like that. After the game, once in a while, he'd offer you a beer afterward, but he didn't have much time then, with night games especially. But he would answer all your questions, and if he had more, he would answer them again the next afternoon while he was doing his charts. He was getting kind of – he'd like somebody to talk to while he was doing his – he was his own analytics. He kept had colored pencils for each different pitcher and where each pitch was hit, what the result was, out or hit. And you could get even better information then. And there weren't many – well, it was only one newspaper then for the most part. And it was quite a pleasant time. He didn't take note of the fact that a lot of the scribes used to go to the Missouri Grill with me during their stay in St. Louis. He says, first night, asking a bunch of questions, go out with Hummel to the grill. Second night, not asking too many, as many questions as the night before. Third night, go out with Hummel again and come in. You're not asking any questions. Oh, I'm asking all the questions. What do you guys do over there anyway? Meaning we're all hungover is what it's
right. Well, the Missouri Grill was legendary, right? That was not just sports, but like a post-dispatch hangout, right?
Well, it was. For a while, it was actually the Globe-Democrat hangout when the Globe existed, and we had a little place called the Press Box right across the south of the newspaper on Tucker there. In fact, it was even called 12th Street then. And then the Globe folded, so we ended up taking over the Missouri Grill as our spot. That was never our spot until the early 80s. And you'd have umpires, broadcasters, and writers. And especially the umpires and the writers kind of formed a fraternity because they're all on the all-opponent team for the players, They didn't hate you, but they didn't have to like you either, And you're all sort of on the enemy side.
You mentioned the Templeton and rehab. When the Hernandez deal went down, I've always been curious about this. How much did everybody know? Because on the outset, it was a terrible trade. It made no sense. And Whitey, for years, didn't say anything, and then it came out. There were drug issues, and Hernandez has talked about it. How well was it known, even in the media world, and was there any temptation, hey, I got to write why they made this move?
You didn't know a lot of the information at that point. When the trade was made, you didn't know. I guess there was some suspicion. And then as we went along, you know, Hernandez got caught up in that Pittsburgh drug trial where it was out there. He was one of the seven guys, he and Parker and Dale Barra and a few other, Tim Raines, I think, and a couple other guys. Andujar was in that, Lonnie Smith. They had three Cardinals in there. And but you didn't know. And it looked like, at first, Whitey was hoping to trade him for Ray Knight, which would have been a better deal. But Houston didn't want to do it. I think he was with Houston then. And so that came down to Neil Allen and Rick Ownby. But two very promising arms. Ownby, kind of a California beach bum guy who just never quite got with it. Allen was pretty good for a while. And then he became the closer when Suter signed with the Braves, and Allen self-destructed. The first series was in New York, of course, and he blew two games in a row for the Mets the first two games of the season, and that was it for him. But, that was a bad trade. Everybody thought it was a bad trade, and Hernandez was not playing all that well at the time. He was hitting 260-something, I think. And he didn't want to go to the Mets. And I don't know that Whitey necessarily wanted to trade him, but the brewery made him. You know, I'd say, you got to get this guy out of here, you know. And as we learned later, you know.
So maybe a misnomer, too. Like Whitey now, we could sit around, we have fun telling stories. But then I've heard he didn't necessarily love the media interaction. And Tony, who people at home assume hated the media, I've always said it's more the opposite. He loved to sit around and BS before a game or after. Well, if they won, after the game, but... Is that fair? Like, Tony loved his – I mean, I he could get mad at you, but he kind of liked the media interaction.
Well, I think Whitey loved the media interaction. He would –
Maybe not TV. Maybe that's what
he didn't like TV or radio.
Okay.
And he said, I want to see something – like, he favored newspapers, and he would say, I want to see something in the paper that I said that I didn't say on TV or radio the night before or whatever. He didn't want to have something special for us. And he didn't go on any talk shows then at all. He didn't. You're part of the media. He did not like that much.
But Tony, you guys had a great rapport, right? And I mean, he liked people who were there every day. He told me that once. It's no disrespect. He said, but I favor the guys who are here every day. And I said, I get that. Like, I never want to push to the front of the line because I'm like, I'm not here every day. And I think he loved the guys who would just talk ball all day.
You're right, and. It took a while to get to know him. You know, the two previous managers were Whitey for 10 years. Well, you can go back a little bit. Red for, 12 years. And then a little bit of Rapp, a little bit of Kenny Boyer. And then Whitey for 10 and Joe Torre for about 5.5. So Tony was new to all of us. And it took maybe 3 or 4 years to figure out how to you could lighten him up a little bit. And I finally figured out one day that I would joke about his, if he was starting to give me a rough time, I'd joke about his batting average, his career 199 batting average, and see where that took me. And he liked it. You know, he started laughing. First he glared at me, of course, and then he said, and then he knew I had him. That's what it was. No home runs, 199.
I want to throw some names at you from over the years. Give me Jack Buck. So you're around the stadium probably a lot of nights at the Old Bush and just being around Jack. So much has been said and written, but what was your interaction with Jack like?
He taught me a lot. And one time we're going downstairs after a game through the double doors that would lead you onto the field at the second ballpark. And the umpire's room was past the first set and off to the right. And he said, you ought to go in there sometime and introduce yourself to the umpires. And now... And then both, there was all kinds of don't, do not enter on, you know, of all kinds of skull and crossbones type stuff on the door there. I said, you can't go in there. He said, sure you can. He says, just go in there.
That's right. You're okay. The commission is being – no, this is – go ahead. We can edit this out, but this could be La Russa.
I'm
this,
just going to get rid of it.
No, this – the commission's phone is ringing. I said, you never know. It could be Rob Manfred.
So anyway, he said, yeah, go in there and introduce yourself. So I did. And over the years, we got to be fast friends, either at the Missouri Grill or before the game, you go in and just talk to them. After the game, you go in and talk to them. And as I established myself at either home games or big events on the road, like playoff games and stuff, the umpires would ask for me to be the pool reporter. They'd say, hey, get Hummel in here. Nobody else comes in. You get Hummel in there, and he explained the play to me. And then I was kind of their go-between, I guess, between Major League Baseball and the media for a long time. But a lot of these guys are my friends still, Joe West. And so I got a couple calls last week from Jerry Davis and Ron Culpa from local umpires. They're congratulating me for 50 years. They'd seen it in the paper. And so that's what Jack Buck taught me, first of all. And then secondly, he was as generous a man as you'll ever see. I went out to dinner with him. He'd invite you out a couple times a year with a group of people. He'd go to like Eli's in Chicago, and he'd have a stack of $20 bills. And this is like 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. And he would give 20s to everybody, the piano player, the busboys, the waiters, go back to the cooks, the maitre d', everybody.
And Joe says, and that's why my dad was working at 80 or whatever it was. Yeah. How about Mike Shannon, his partner? You're working on a book. Boy, how do you put the Shannon life into one book? That'll be a fascinating read.
Well, there's different aspects of it. His great career as a high school athlete here, maybe among the top four or five best high school athletes we've ever had for all round athleticism. You know, football, baseball. I think he was a pretty good basketball player too. And then there's his playing career in the big leagues and what his playing career might have been at Mizzou had he actually played there other than freshman football. And then his 50 years of broadcasting, which is the centerpiece of the book. And a lot of broadcasters have agreed to talk to me about him. I just haven't got them all lined up yet. But that'll be the primary focus. And the key is that Mike remembers a lot of the stories. And there's some that over the years have kind of slipped his mind a little bit, and these other guys, I need to remind him of those stories, then we'll get some more information.
Maybe some have grown over the years, too, embellished a little
bit. That could well be. That could well be, and some probably could not be in the book, maybe,
And when you were a young reporter at the paper, Costas was a young broadcaster, where you covered the St. Louis Spirits.
Yes.
Did you know Bob at all then?
Not until they got there, no, but yes, very well, because he would have it on his radio show with KMOX every now and again, and we had a wonderful time doing that. I recall being what little travel we did was just the All-Star game and some playoffs and maybe one other game during the regular season. But he'd be the last guy on the plane. He insisted on coming back from New York to St. Louis after the Nets series one time in the playoffs, and he insisted he could get from his place in New York City to LaGuardia in like 22 minutes. Come on now. Right. You can't do that. But he did. He made most of the flights, and you didn't have to be on the plane a half hour before it took off. You just did the last guy on there. Okay, here we go, full, let's take off. But we've known each other since 1974. How long is that? 47 years.
47. Could you tell then, hey, this guy's going to be special?
Oh, yeah. His memory, his elocution, his ability to – we were talking about interviews before you started this session here. He's one of the best interviewers I've ever been around. He makes you feel comfortable, but yet he gets whatever he wants to get out of you or anybody else.
And Coach K, there's a link here. The legendary Mike Krzyzewski, there's a link to the commish.
In, 1969, I was at Fort Carson, Colorado, at a division unit, and we had a base newspaper that I was a sports editor for, and I worked downtown at the Colorado Springs paper at night. But then Mike Krzyzewski, I could say it then, now, was a year younger than I, and he graduated from West Point, and he had a five-year duty assignment. And his first year, he assisted Bob Knight on the bench at West Point, and then Knight went to Indiana after that. And then Mike's second assignment was to come to Fort Carson to be the special services director and the player coach of the Fort Carson basketball team, which was quite a good club. And I was trying to use proper protocol. I'd call him Lieutenant Krzyzewski, and he would call me, you know, whatever he wanted to call me. And finally, after, I don't know, a month or so of this, he says, look, he said, why don't you just call me Mike, and I'll call you Rick. Well, that was unprecedented in 1969 for a West Point guy to treat you like that. So we were there together for a year or so. He got sent to Korea after that, and I got out the year after that. And we maintained a little bit of contact over the years, not much. There was a game, he's a Duke now, it's in 1994, during the baseball strike and the lockout. They weren't going to, there was no baseball going on in the offseason, no talk or anything. They weren't going to play, probably, until later in 95, which is true. I was going to cover a Duke-Illinois game over at Cameron Indoor Stadium. Illinois is really good. Duke really good. They won 80-some non-conference games in a row at home. I thought I'd call the Duke PR department and see if I could get an interview with them. And the guy said, well, we got this conference call with you guys in Springfield and Chicago and whoever other reporters from Illinois. It's Tuesday or whatever. So the conference call comes on, and we all introduce ourselves. And he's listening. And I introduce myself. And he says, okay, before this goes any farther, he says, I was in the Hummel, in the Army, excuse me, I was in the Army with Hummel, and he was not exactly a Green Beret. And I was dumbfounded. I had no response to that, of course.
It's a great line.
And then I didn't see him again. I saw him at that game. I sat in the back. I had not seen him in person for 24 years. And he walked right to the back of the room, stuck out his hand, and introduced himself. I knew, of course, he was, and said, how you doing? So we go on now to about 13 or 14 years later. I'm in Atlanta covering the NCAA regionals. St. Louis had a regional at that point, too. And Illinois was playing, and they lost the first game. But now I'm covering, I think, Duke beat Xavier maybe in the final eight. And so I'm sitting in the front row of the press for the press conference, and their coaches are coming up, and I snap off a snappy salute as Coach K sees me, and he says, what the hell are you doing here? I said, well, I'm doing basketball. And he's a big Cubs fan, and this is before the Cubs were really any good. And he says, you know, this is going to be our year. I said, it is never your year. I was wrong about that, of course. And then I haven't talked to him since.
Haven't congratulated him on that 2016 World Series title, no.
I tried. and I almost broke through. And finally, he was about ready to tell me how he felt about it. And he said, you know, if I do it for you, I got to do it for everybody else. I'm just going to stay out of it for right now, until he did. But
noted,
I almost had it.
Noted Cubs fan, Coach K. I was not aware of that. I also love the Leon Spinks story and the famous person who told you to get lost. This is in the Catskills, is that right?
Yeah. This is between Spinks having beaten Ali in Las Vegas in February. The rematch is going to be in the Superdome in November. And this is like late August or September, and Leon's going to train in the Catskills for this next fight. And I was covering the Cardinals and Mets in New York on a weekend, and I took a couple days to go up to the Catskills and do another Leon story. And Leon and I were tight, you know. I had covered him from Golden Gloves to Olympic trials to win in the first fight over Ali. And he's doing it kind of like poolside. I'm at the back end of the pool, and questions on and on. He points back in my direction and says, get him out of here. I'm thinking, wait, what do you wonder what he's talking about? Well, he was talking about me.
He wanted you out of that press conference.
Yeah, and I said, what's going on? He said, I didn't like that photograph that you ran of me in the paper. Well, this was right after he'd been stopped for a traffic violation at 4 o'clock at the White Castle on a Sunday morning. A Globe Democrat ran a picture. And later it was revealed that Leon had cocaine in his hat band also, besides various traffic violations. I said, we didn't do that. That wasn't my paper. He didn't believe that. So I started arguing a little more, and this big meaty hand grabs my arm. That's Mr. T, is his bodyguard then. He says, I think you better go. I thought, well, you know, that's probably a good idea at this point. So.
And as Coach K said, you're not a Green Beret, yeah. So maybe it's...
Yeah.
But at that time, nobody knew who Mr. T was. Did he have a distinct look?
He had the big earring, he had the bald head, and he looked big and mean.
Menacing.
And his grip was certainly firm.
Did you and Leon ever talk about that later, how it was identity?
No, it never happened. I mean, we talked later, but he didn't ever agree that it was a different paper. And people unexpected know, I guess there were two papers in town then or whatever, but we didn't do it. I didn't do it.
So from getting kicked out in the Catskills by Mr. T and Leon Spinks, you end up in upstate New York going into Cooperstown, summer 2007, for your baseball writing. What did that mean to you? And what does it mean to have that legacy forever?
I was most surprised by how happy everybody else seemed to be about this. Not that I wasn't happy myself. I was very happy. But I got people congratulating me and wanting me to sign balls and telling me what a great job they thought I had done that I didn't even know, let alone the people that I did know that said roughly the same things. So that was the most meaningful part about that, was that it affected many more people than I had ever dreamed. And now to have that legacy, well, sure. I mean, people call me a Hall of Famer. I'm not in that other Hall of Fame with the plaques and stuff. I have a picture. I'm very happy with that. And another wing, I'm in there. But they treat me as royalty, and I will always treasure their reverence for me, whether it's misguided or not. I mean, I treasure that.
And the 50-year milestone, your line was, I walked into the Post-Dispatch 50 years ago, and they haven't told me to stop yet. It's changed a lot, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The whole deal?
Yeah.
The
I mean, there's, you know, you see all these movies, typewriters clacking away, and people yelling, copy, and people running around like mad. Now there are people on computers. It's all very quiet and not nearly as exciting in the newsroom. Because I'm not in the newsroom much anymore, so maybe it is. I'm just not there much anymore. But in the old days, you'd have a story breaking and people running around like crazy and sending stuff down the tubes to the composing room. And just typewriters were different. I mean, maybe there are people today that probably aren't even aware what a typewriter looks like. Mm-hmm. And do you ever see one anymore?
I always say my broadcast career was aided greatly by D.C. Wilcutt, who was a legendary basketball coach at CBC. I said, for one thing, he knew I wasn't good enough to play varsity basketball, but he was also my typing instructor. I learned how to type, and as you know, TV or newspaper, you're constantly on a keyboard, even to this day, and that's where I learned to type. But you're right, I don't know the last time I saw a typewriter other than a museum. But you've persevered. I mean, you've rolled with the changes. You even tweet on occasion. Typically about Tim Lincecum, and I've never
Matt Cain. Matt Cain.
I'm sorry, Matt Cain, getting my Giants pitchers mixed up. And that is why?
They were on me from the office to get involved in Twitter. This is maybe 12 to 15 years ago. Matt Cain was an up-and-coming pitcher with the Giants. He was pitching that night against the Cardinals and having a rough time of it. And so Bernie Nicholas, who was with me at that time, next to me as a columnist, showed me how to get it set up, and so I did some tweets about Matt Cain, and then I was never forced to do any more. And then Matt Cain did something else about, I don't know, maybe 5 years later with the Cardinals. Like, he beat them in 4th of July or something. I thought, well, this might be a good time to go back into it again. So like every 4 or 5 years I would do Matt Cain, and then Matt Cain was going to retire, and he announced that the last Saturday of the season, maybe 2016 or 17. I knew that Matheny had caught him. So I went down and talked to him about Matt Cain. And there's another tweet. And I don't know what he's doing now.
Was he ever aware of this? Probably
I don't
not.
I don't know. I've never had any contact with him. I've never spoken to the man, but surely somebody must have said, well, how do you know? Who's this guy? Who's this humble guy? What kind of, I don't know.
So 50 years, not all of it around baseball, but most of it, and you end up in the Hall of Fame as a baseball writer. What's your thought on baseball moving forward? I feel like I've had this conversation with Joe Buck where we're constantly saying the game's dying, the game's dying, and yet the money's flying in and there's superstars all over the place, fun, dynamic young players. We're always trying to fix the game. What's your hope or thoughts over the next 10, 20 years?
I'd like to see them keep the rules the same for a little longer than 1 or 2 years, you know. But as I understand it, most of the rules changes were made to speed up the game. Well, the games are getting longer, so maybe they're not working, okay?
Right.
I mean, maybe the three-batter rule is not a good rule. I mean, I do see extra inning games going faster by putting the guy at second base, but I don't like that. Why do you play the 10th inning different than the first? This isn't like a hockey shootout. I mean, in basketball, when it's an overtime, the only difference is they don't play as many minutes in a period. The rules are still the same. You don't get 4 points for a three-point goal in overtime or whatever. Why change the rules now? Joe's right about there is some hope in people like Ohtani and Tatis Jr. and Ronald Acuna Jr. and Soto and guys like that are coming aboard. But the games have too many of these predictable outcomes: strikeout, home run, and walk. Maybe not as many now with the gooey stuff not being right. applied as much anymore. That's why you see so many balls off the backstop now, I think, and more than you did the rest of the season, maybe. Guys just don't have their grip anymore, whether it was illegal or not. I don't think baseball can afford to keep changing the rules every year, and they're going to have to play a little bit more of an exciting brand of ball where some aspects of play never seem to come into vogue. I mean, if you see a triple, like now and again, but that's because somebody fell down in the outfield, probably, or dived for a ball and missed it. You don't see a stolen base that much. Bunting, there's pros and cons about bunting. I don't like position players bunting. I think they're up there to hit. Pitchers should be bunting. Now, pitchers won't have to worry about that after this year because they're going to be a DH all the time. But I want to see more parts of the game, hit and run, you know, more guys in motion, because you start making the fielders move around more than just what they're doing on their shifts. They're going to miss a ball now and again. These guys aren't infallible. You've got to make a guy run to a position trying to field a ball on the run while there's a runner passing in front of him or an outfielder rushing a throw because he might be going to third. That's part of the game. Put some pressure on the defense. Home runs only put pressure on the pitcher. They don't put pressure on the defense. You can't catch them.
Mm-hmm. Kamish, so much fun to catch up. When we post this segment, I might see if I can get you to retweet it. What are the odds of that?
I would do that, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
How about that? We might have a retweet from the Kamish, and it's not Matt Cain related. Kamish, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking.
So many great stories over the year. The Kamish, Rick Hummel, still going strong. Love the fact his family, they call him Rick or Ricky. They don't call him the Kamish, but everybody else does. Love those tales, especially Leon Spinks having Mr. T as part of his posse years ago. We're going to talk to Matt Holliday. I believe that'll be coming out on Tuesday about playing at Coors Field with the All-Star game there. Also, his first half assessment of the Cardinals and how much blame should a hitting coach get. We'll get in depth with that with Matt Holliday. The Kill Quinn Conversation available on iTunes, Spotify, at a truck stop. If you happen to just be standing next to me, you can also subscribe. And all of our segments are posted at ScoopsWithDannyMac.com, the Cardinals broadcaster. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the All-Star game. We'll talk soon.